Well, I tell people regularly there's no place like the Sunburst class, and I know I'm biased, but the way you people keep up with each other and pray for each other, and that's a real blessing. So just rejoicing with the good reports and the progress that are being made. We continue to pray for these folks, and it's a great day at First Baptist Dallas. It's 150 years, of course, of celebration, and I think maybe you'll agree, as we grow older, we appreciate things in our past and people even more. And it's an interesting thing. I remember coming over here at least once a year in the summer. I grew up 110 miles east of here. But my parents, every summer, we'd come over to hear Dr. Crystal preach in his white suit. Y'all remember that? And my parents loved this church. And then in the providence of God, my sister, 20 months older, married a First Baptist guy, and I married a First Baptist girl. And in fact, my mother used to say when I was a kid, you know, Matthew, when you go off to Baylor one day, you need to marry a good girl from First Baptist Dallas. And so I called her one night, and I said, Mom, remember what you said? And about what? I said, about the girl from First Baptist Dallas. And she said, yeah, what about it? I said, well, I want you to meet her. I got her. I found her. And 6 months later, we got married. So, but it goes on even there, farther from there. So I'm doing doctoral work, and you have to write a dissertation. What are you going to write about? And I chose to write about Dr. Criswell's preaching. And so that led to hours and hours of listening to audio sermons and listening to tapes watching video to the point where I got pretty good at a couple you, a family you, just one somebody you in the balcony around, in the great press of people along this lower floor. You guys remember that. But I say all that to say, what a blessing. What a blessing. At whatever point along the way that God has led you to First Baptist, you just see that the hand of God, and Bob just mentioned, or someone else mentioned, the providence of God. And I thought, as we've looked at 1 and 2 Samuel, don't you see that almost on every page? Crazy stuff seemingly happens, but at the end of the way, God's hand is indelibly on the whole situation. And I think that's what we see more and more. Well, this morning, all the king's enemies. I was looking at this text this week and thought of that old rhyme, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses, all the king's men couldn't put old Humpty back together again. Well, we are looking at the aftermath of David's sin with Bathsheba and then his cover-up and then the resulting judgment that comes on the house of David. That's where we are. Now, last week, we looked at three friends of David, Ittai, Zadok, and Hushai. And we talked about the fact that God, even in the midst of David's difficulty, of his experiencing God's corrective discipline, right? God encourages him, gives him friends. Well, in today's text, we go from three friends to three enemies. Today, we look at Ziba, and we look at Shimei, and then finally Ahithophel. And I think as we look at these guys, you're gonna realize that a lot of us have had a Shimei or an Ahithophel, or we may have even had a Ziba in our lives. And so we're going to see how David deals with the enemies and opponents in his life. Now, I don't have to tell you guys, you live long enough, you're going to face opposition. You're going to have opponents. You're going to have enemies. A few years ago, I was introduced to a new term. Y'all may know it. It's the combination term frenemy. You know what a frenemy is? A frenemy is an enemy that's a friend, and a friend that can be an enemy at the same time. I'm not sure how that works, but I remember, you know, those old statements, keep your friends closer and your enemies even closer. Today, it's a fascinating story. But once again, what are we going to see? Think about Psalm 23. In the presence of my enemies, you spread a table before me. You anoint my head with oil. And we're going to see that demonstrated in this text. What about the presence of God when you're in the presence of enemies? Well, we're going to learn today that when you're in the face of opposition, you may have the presence of enemies all around you, but you do not lose the presence of Yahweh. And that's a comforting thing. All right, well, let's look at it then. By way of introduction, we said three friends to three enemies, and I've just identified those enemies. And then I think another thing it's important to point out here, that David is not just another guy. I mean, we could say, oh, David has committed adultery. He's murdered to cover it up. He did those things. He certainly did. God said there would be judgment. But what I want to point out is you've got to remember in this narrative for the David story that David is just not just another guy. Sure, he's a sinner, and now he's a sufferer for those sins, but he is God's anointed servant. And remember how in 1 Samuel, David had every opportunity, it seemed, to mow down Saul, but he would not touch the Lord's anointed. You know, he said, that's God's anointed guy. What we are going to see today in this text is those who come to oppose David in ways that are subtle and even overt. But at the same time, we've got to remember that David is under God's judgment, right, for his sin. But David is also God's elected servant. And when God elects an anointed servant, you can't impeach him. That's just it. And David was God's anointed servant. And so keep that in mind as we work through this text this morning. All right, let's look at enemy number one, Ziba, the opportunistic manipulator. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him. Now, y'all remember Mephibosheth. He was the crippled, lame son of Jonathan. Remember, Ziba was basically his servant who tended all of his properties. And remember in 2 Samuel 9 that Mephibosheth appeared before David and David had summoned him and David gave to him all the land and all the property that belonged to him as a part of the Saul family, right? And so Ziba is his servant. So keep that in mind. Let's look at these first four verses. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba the servant of Mephibosheth met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. Man, I mean, you look at that and you think, well, it almost seems inappropriate. What are you doing, Matthew? Why are you calling Ziba an enemy? Look at this guy. David is fleeing. He's got a bunch of his men with him. It's hot. They're probably tired. And he shows up with the equivalent of a food truck today. All right? All the stuff they need. Well, what's wrong about that? Well, I would just say at this point, you need to be careful here. You've heard people talk about greasing the wheels, setting somebody up. That's what Ziba is doing. So look at what happens. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." Now, I think it's interesting what happens next. Now, I don't want to read into Scripture, and too often teachers, preachers make a bigger deal about what's not in the text and what is in the text. So I don't want to do that, but notice how abrupt things are. David asks the question, "Why have you brought these things?" He gets the answer, and then immediately David is going to shift gears. And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" Well, who's being referred to? Ziba had been a servant in the house of Saul, and Jonathan is Saul's son. The term son is used in a somewhat elastic way, can refer to son or grandson. And so essentially David is asking in the ancient way it was done then in Hebrew, "Hey, well, I'm happy about that, but it's like he moves on. And what about Mephibosheth? And now, you've got this deceptive approach, and it seems almost inappropriate to so indict Ziba, but we're going to see it's certainly appropriate. But it reminds me of an important principle. A long time ago, I heard a wise old preacher say, "Matthew, beware of those who meet you at the train." And I thought, what on earth does that mean? He said, I'm telling you, when you're in any position of leadership, you're going to have wonderful relationships. People will love you and pray for you. But there also may be folks who come along and they jump on board with you when you're the new guy in town, and they really want to friend you up and butter you up. And the reason they're doing that is they're trying to get something. They want, whether it's position or power or whatever, that is exactly what you're going to see Ziba do here. Okay, so we've got the deceptive approach. Now, the slanderous account. And where is your master's son? Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father." You see what's happening here? Ziba is slandering Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth has been brought into the king's table, and now Ziba is painting him as this ingrate who's glad that Absalom is coming to take over, which was not the case at all, as later text, 2 Samuel 19, will tell us. So apparently it's advantageous for Ziba to throw his master now, Mephibosheth, under the bus in order to get something out of David. Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." You see a transfer of assets. David is in a tight spot. He's running for his life. He's had to leave Jerusalem. And so now he's approached by Ziba. Ziba tells him the story that, hey, Mephibosheth, to whom you've been so kind, has sold you out, which was a lie. And so without having opportunity to check the situation out, what happens? David says, "Well, I'll tell you what, that I'm going to transfer all of the assets, all of the holdings that Mephibosheth has, they're now yours." And Ziba is thinking, yeah, presto, worked perfectly. Look at what he says. And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." I've just thrown you under the bus. You ever notice many, many times when people are engaged in dastardly acts of deception, they will cloak it in spiritual sounding language? What a warning to us. Just because the language sounds good and it sounds so spiritual, it might be on the inside just rotten to the core. What a picture. Ziba is not loyal to God's king. He's loyal to his own greed for gain. He capitalizes on the trouble of someone else in order to line his own pocket. Let me read a quick story. I don't do this often, but this is so good. Listen to this picture. The modern-day spirit of Ziba lives on. This is Dale Ralph Davis. "You have heard of the horrible winter the Continental Army suffered at Valley Forge." Okay. "Clothes were so threadbare and blankets so rare that troops often sat up all night rather than fall asleep and freeze to death. Lafayette saw their soldiers whose legs had frozen black. They were taken to hospitals for amputation. Why such suffering? It was not the severe winter, for the winter was mild by Pennsylvania standards. But soldiers went hungry because nearby farmers preferred to sell to the British in Philadelphia for hard cash. The army was half naked because merchants in Boston refused to move government clothing off their shelves at anything less than profits ranging from 1,000 to 1,800%. The colonies swarmed with Zibas. The hardship of others was their opportunity for success." Now, is the primary focus of this text today Ziba? No, it's David and how people interacted with David, but I don't think we can miss that. The New Testament, Jesus says to his disciples, "Be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves." Well, in a lot of cases, we've got the harmless as doves down. We need to work on the wise as serpents maybe a little bit. Well, let's look at the next one. This will sound familiar. We're going to look at Shimei, the verbal abuser. When King David came to Bahurim, that's east of Jerusalem, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. All right, so we know this is a descendant of Saul, and he's not just that, he's an ancient trash talker. I saw an interesting article the other day. Football season's about to begin here in a few weeks, and there were some polls taken among college football players to rank in order the best, if that's possible to call them best, the best trash talkers in college football. When you trash talk, as you know, you're trying to intimidate, you're trying to harass the opponent verbally. Well, Shimei may have written the book. Well, he's the son of Gera, and as he came, he cursed continually. He doesn't just curse continually. He chunked stones at David and all the servants of David, and all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. Look at this, verse 7. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you're a man of blood. Well, what's going on there? Well, the issue for Shimei is not David's sin with Bathsheba and cover-up that resulted. He may or may not have even known about that. But the issue with Shimei is that he feels like that David has disrespected and undermined the Saul dynasty. He's a descendant of Saul. Mistreatment of the Saul dynasty. Now, that's his perception. We see no biblical evidence of that. I mean, David had multiple opportunities to put Saul to death. David honored a commitment he made some 20 to 25 years earlier, taking care of Mephibosheth. He moves into power, so there seems to be nothing to that. But here's this guy who has just stewed in the juices of his own rage for who knows how long. And now he comes cursing and screaming and throwing stuff. Well, it gets look at Abishai's recommendation. You know, I think sometimes we really identify with old Abishai. Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog stop there?" A dog, by the way, in the Jewish culture is not like most of our dogs today. I see increasingly these dogs dressed up. They're dressed nicer than people, you know. They're in the car, sitting in the front seat with the person driving. I think I saw a dog texting the other day. I'm not sure. In the Jewish mindset, a dog, if you were a dog, they were scavengers, unclean, nasty, nasty animals. So if you want to really, humiliate and insult someone, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head. You know, you got to kind of like a guy like Abishai. Why are we putting up with this? Who is this nut? Let me take care of this. But then look at David's response. But the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David,' who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" Now, this is interesting. Is David saying he likes being verbally harassed, abused? No. Apparently, David has some insight into what's going on here that he needs to just step back and be still and look at what he says. And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more may this Benjaminite leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me." Now, you may see some notations in your translations. That's because there's an interesting there's an interesting thing going on with the Hebrew text. But it is quite possible that the best reading of this text is so that it's shaped like this. It may be that the Lord will look on my iniquity, that is, David's talking about his sin, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. I think that fits best with the context. When you're going to decide what's going on in the text, you've got to look linguistically, what's happening with the language, the grammar, and the syntax. You've got to look at the argument or the scene that is in the text and that expands beyond it. But in essence, David is saying, I've sinned against the Lord. And I know the Lord has not abandoned me. And it may be, I'm not saying God's bound to do what I want him to do or expect him to do, but it may be that God, even in the midst of what I'm experiencing judgment for my iniquity, it may be that God will replace the curse with a blessing. Isn't that beautiful? You think, Matthew, wishful thinking, big boy. What's going on here? Not so fast. Jump ahead to Galatians 3:13. What does the text say about Jesus? Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law. What is the message of the gospel if it's not a message about reversing the curse? And in an ancient sort of way, and I'm not saying this is full-blown New Testament theology here. Please don't go home and say that. But I'm saying it points to that. What's the gospel? It's reversing the curse. He redeemed us from the law, becoming a curse for us. And the text goes on to say Jesus became the incarnation, the personification, the substitution, the substituting curse when he took our place on the cross. So I'm just saying that David could have gotten all upset at this guy that's chunking rocks and cussing. But David's saying, David's thinking, he's been humbled. He's saying, I probably deserve all that and more. Somebody asked Spurgeon how he dealt with those who opposed him and verbally abused him. He said, if they knew the real truth, if they think I'm so bad, if they knew the real truth, they'd realize how bad I really am. So I think maybe David is there a little bit. He's been humbled, and he's saying, let the guy curse. Maybe God told him to. Maybe this is part of my training, my schooling in the course of recovery. I'm just going to trust in God's character. And so I think that's the best way to look at it. Yeah, Jesus redeems us from the law. How? By becoming the curse for us. Okay, one other area, 15 through 23, Ahithophel, the calculating betrayer. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem and Ahithophel with him. How important was Ahithophel? I want you to look at the end of this chapter, verse 23. In those days, the counsel Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted with the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and Absalom. I mean, I'm telling you, Ahithophel was a big-time counselor, had the ears of kings, was esteemed and valued. But you know that in the midst of all this tumult, what does he do? He sells out David. He attaches himself to Absalom. What's even worse than that, the advice he gives is absolutely catastrophic. Let's look at it. Now Absalom and the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, remember him last time, came to Absalom, Hushai said of Absalom, to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? You see what Absalom's saying, your friend David? What about your friend David? Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I've served your father, so will I serve you. Now remember, David keep, David had instructed Hushai to stay in his position, not for the purpose of deception. One could view these words of Hushai as deceptive, but I don't think you have to. I think Hushai is saying, look, I'm a loyal servant to the king on the throne in Jerusalem. And in his mind, he's thinking that king, David, asked me to stay here, and I'm going to be loyal to whatever king God has here. But Absalom probably misinterprets that to think, he sold himself out. He's no longer devoted to David. He's now attached his loyalty to me. So it's a fascinating thing here. Hushai's words and then Absalom's assumption. Now look at verse 20. Here's where it gets treacherous. Ahithophel's advice and Absalom's actions. Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your counsel, what shall we do? Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father at the hands of all who are with you, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. Now, I don't have the time this morning to get into the fact that, you know, the Bible never condones polygamy. Always the model from Genesis 2 has been monogamy. And any time in Scripture you see men going outside those bounds, then things get really dicey in a hurry, don't they? Well, David has this royal harem, so to speak, concubines. And essentially Ahithophel's advice is, I want you to go in and have sexual relations with all those all of your father's women. And immediately what comes to mind is what? 2 Samuel 12, 10, 11, and 12. Remember what the Lord said? David, you committed sexual sin in secret. But look what's coming in judgment. Behold, I'll raise up evil against you out of your own house. I'll take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son, for you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And so look what happens. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof. Portable chamber there. Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Here, see that phrase? In the sight of all Israel. Well, isn't that sordid? I mean, if you were going to attach a movie rating to chapter 16, we'd have to be really careful, wouldn't we? But I want you to see that God is describing these things, recording them in His Word for a purpose. We see the dereliction, the devastation, the disgusting nature of sin. But I want to point out, what was the goal that Ahithophel had in mind? Through his advice to Absalom, he's wanting to totally discredit and totally overthrow David as king. And in the end, of course, he was not successful. That was a man's goal. That was the enemy's goal. But in another sense, y'all, this happening was also the execution of the discipline and judgment that God was bringing on David and his house. And you see, that kind of blows our minds. Wait, how can evil, despicable acts perpetrated, encouraged, advised by Ahithophel, how can that somehow serve the purposes of God, whether it's in judgment or in exaltation or whatever? Well, hold on. Before you say that's a complete impossibility, Matthew, well, let's check a couple of New Testament verses out. Just listen to 1 Corinthians 11:23. Paul is writing about the Lord's Supper, he says, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night in which he was betrayed, took bread." There was a greater than King David who was betrayed by his own friends. Fascinating. Well, and remember that story? Judas deliberately betrays the Lord for 30 pieces of silver. Jesus is arrested and crucified. Those evil men are held accountable. The book of Acts, this Son of God, you crucified. You're accountable. You're responsible. But then Peter and Paul both turn around in Acts and say, you did this, but God was in control. Romans 8:32. He who did not spare his own son, but handed him over for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Do you see what I'm saying? And I love this. As crazy as this chapter is, and as crazy as our lives can be sometimes, even when we think we can't even begin to fathom how even the smallest scintilla of a experience could somehow be redeemed for positive measures. Yet God can take what man means for evil. God can take what people do in their limited perspective, and he can accomplish his purposes. He's in control. And I think David had come to some sort of understanding of that. Lord, I may be surrounded by enemies, but I'm also surrounded by your presence, and you're in charge. Well, because God is in control, and by the way, you either believe that or you don't. God's not halfway in control to this morning. Either you believe he's totally in control, the only other option is if he's not totally in control, he's not in control at all. Because God is in control and cares for his own, confide in him when opposition comes. Simple, isn't it? I wish I could tell you every time I have faced opposition of any form, difficulty, that I have immediately been driven to my knees to confide in God. But that would not be true. I'm a slow learner. The Lord has to take me and shape me and teach me. And I'm sure it's not too different for some of you. Second, I love the hymn by Charles Wesley, "His Kingdom," speaking of the reign of Jesus, "His kingdom cannot fail. He rules o'er earth and heaven. The keys of death and hell are to our Jesus given." That's a good word, man. Our class has been rocked by difficulties, health problems lately. But what a strong encouragement. Number three, stake your life on the stability of God's kingdom plan. What's stable in your life today? We've been reminded recently, health is not a stable thing. We knew it. It wasn't a stable thing when we were 20. It's sure not a stable thing when we're 65 or 70, right? God's kingdom plan will not fail. Link up, hook up with what lasts. And then find consolation in God's character. That's what David did. I love this old quote. I couldn't find the original source, but I love the old quote, "God is too kind to be cruel, too wise to make a mistake, and too deep to be fully understood." Isn't that good? God's too kind to be cruel. He's too wise to make a mistake. And he's too deep for me to understand fully. I think David was learning a little bit of that. And I think that's something that we can learn as well. God is in control. And his purposes will stand. Lord, thanks for today. Thanks for my friends in the Sunburst class. Lord, you know we all need you. We all need you desperately. But lately we've been reminded yet again of how deep and how massive our need for you is. Father, remind us that we are strangers and aliens and pilgrims. I pray that we would have shallow tent pegs and we would remember that this is not our home. But Father, while we are here, I pray that we would find consolation in your character, your wisdom, your worth, your power, and your control. So arm us with these reminders from your word this week that we might exalt and magnify your Son. This is our prayer in his name. Amen. Y'all have a great week.